thank you for those, Kathy. It's always good to learn a new one. And I can't always tell with the Frank Garlock ones because he's been around. He was around for so long and heard him a lot. So it's a matter of, okay, that's going way back in my memory if I have. So let's turn to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. And I think I'll mention it kind of one more time because we're about to get back into a normal, back into the chapter orders being chronological order. We noted the chapter order chronologically is chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, then chapters 7 and 8, then chapter 5 and chapter 6, and then chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. So we're about to get out of our back order. We're going kind of back in time chronologically, as you see in verse 1. It says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. And so we're kind of going back in time from where we were just a couple chapters ago, because we were there with Darius the Mede, which was after the Babylonian Empire. So we're going back in time. And noting Daniel's second vision, his first one in chapter 7. We also move to the last main point of our Daniel outline, and that is Daniel the faithful Israelite concerning Israel and Gentile dominion. And our focus changes somewhat as we move forward, and I don't know that I mentioned it as we were going through. But Daniel, I think I may have mentioned that at the beginning, but I didn't give the chapter division, so to speak. But Daniel was written in two languages, in Hebrew and Aramaic. And Hebrew, obviously, being for the Jews, Aramaic was a broader language. The Babylonians spoke Aramaic. And that was used in chapter 2 through chapter 7, which kind of makes sense because it was Daniel and his friends interacting with Babylonians. So that would kind of make sense to be using their language to be talking about this section. But we come back to the Hebrew now because now our attention changes. Daniel is not addressing the Babylonians. He's addressing Israel and what their fate has, again, with the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, the times of the Gentiles. Again, noting that back, if you have your little outline, the folder, going back to those introductory paragraphs that we quoted there from one of our commentators, noting those terms, the fullness of the Gentiles, the times of the Gentiles, and the like, and the distinctions there that regard really, you know, Israelite history and prophecy concerning Israel as it interacts with Gentile powers in Daniel's day, looking forward to what was happening, of course, with the Babylonian Empire, what will happen with the Medo-Persian Empire and the Grecian Empire and the Roman Empire, and then that final empire, the revived Roman Empire in the end times. So we come back to the Hebrew. And we have this vision that Daniel has, and it's 2 years after his vision that he had in chapter 7. Remember chapter 7, verse 1, it was in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions. Here in verse 1 of chapter 8, he says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. So he's noting, this is the second one. I had that first one, and now another vision has come to me. And I saw, in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before me, before the river, a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. He says, And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, or rage, and smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. We'll stop there for a moment. I trust we've kind of got an image of what we have here of these two animals, and we'll get some interpretation here in the coming verses. But we see this taking place. We see some of the animation, if you will, and some characteristics about these that we'll touch on as we get into the interpretation that the angel Gabriel is going to give him in these coming verses. But I want to kind of read kind of through this all and then come back and let's look at these pieces and the dynamics to it, if you will. So we'll continue in verse 15. It says, and it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking unto me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. So there is no debate what this is. The ram is the Medo-Persian Empire. He continues, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So now we know who the he-goat is. It's the Grecian Empire. And he notes that the first king is very great, but he's going to be cut off, and in his place are going to rise up four, but they're not going to have the power like he had, which kind of makes sense. If you're going to divide something into fours, the fours aren't going to be as strong as the one because the one has been divided. So he notes this. And again, this is why the liberals just hate the book of Daniel. He is so precise in his prophetic looking forward. that, you know, the liberals who don't believe in the supernatural, who don't believe that God can do these things, just say, you know, this had to be written after the fact. Because, you know, in Daniel's day, Greece was just a bunch of city-states. I mean, they were squabbling amongst themselves. How in the world could he know that Greece would rise up and be something? Well, Daniel didn't. God gave him the vision and then taught him what the vision means. So he's prophesying of these things are going to come to pass. We continue, verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. So he's noting within that Grecian empire, as it gets towards the end of it, there's going to be one of those in that group of four kingdoms that's going to be rather notable. He's going to be wise. He's going to be a fierce countenance. And his power, verse 24, shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. And he shall magnify himself in his heart and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And so again, we have a little distinction here and about this particular character, which we'll bring up and kind of reveal here in a moment. And we'll talk further about this as we get into chapter 11 particularly. Chapter 11 can be confusing in the going back and forth between the king of the north and the king of the south. And I have been trying to find something that is that can be helpful kind of visually to show that. And thank you, Pastor Post. One of those books in Daniel has a diagram that will help me there, that I will make copies of for when we get there, that kind of helps delineate this instead of just reading these verses and this going back and forth and this intrigue, which there is a lot of intrigue going back and forth, kind of lays it out a little more visually to help kind of unscrabble those verses that we get there. But he's touching on it some here in noting what's going to happen in the coming days under the Grecian Empire. So let's go back and kind of rehash this a little bit and notice this. As he tells us, the ram is the Medo-Persian Empire. It has two horns, but one is more notable than the other. Did we see a similar thing in chapter 7 concerning the bear, which was the Medo-Persian Empire? The bear was kind of lopsided, humped over on one side. One side was enlarged, the other one was smaller, depicting the rise, really, of the Persian Empire being the more dominant between this alliance. The Medes kind of start, as he notes here, but the smaller one kind of came up first, because as we saw with the ending of Belshazzar, with his handwriting on the wall, who entered Babylon? Darius the Mede. The start of the Medo-Persian Empire was kind of predominated, if you will, by the Medo side rather than the Persian side. But eventually, Persia is going to be the stronger of the two. And as we come here, the Greece is going to be particularly fighting the Persians. Yes, it's the Medo-Persian Empire, but the kings are basically Persians. They're not Medes. They've intermarried, yes, to make those alliances, but it's Persia is dominating. And so he notes that. Again, this depiction is really rather precise in knowing this. It's like, this has got to be after the fact. No, it's before. God knows the future. He knows what's going to happen. And so if he knows what's going to happen, can he depict it accurately? Yes, he can. Can he depict it accurately enough in a vision to a man on the earth so that he can kind of understand it? Yes, he can. Regardless of what was going on in his day with the various powers. I'm sure Daniel, being in his position within the Babylonian Empire, would know of the rustlings to the east of the Medo-Persian alliances that were forming and growing. So that kingdom would not be something that Daniel would not know about, because that is growing during his day while he's under Babylon. The Grecian Empire, that's a little different because it's not an empire. It's a bunch of city-states, Sparta, Athens, Corinth, Thrace, you know, all these little places, if you will, and their area around them, they have their own little kingdoms. It's going to be Philip of Macedon, Alexander's father, that's going to start uniting them together. And eventually, Alexander will take over and really expand. But in the meantime, our focus really is on these and this change that takes place between these two as the Medo-Persian Empire expands, and he notes that as it goes in the various directions to spread out, which the Medo-Persian Empire did. And it headed west, as we see in verse 9, it says, "And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. It waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down," excuse me, that's the he-goat. Go back up. I went down too far. Verse 4, there we go, back to the ram, to the Medo-Persian Empire. "And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward." And so we have those compass directions. Again, the Medo-Persian was primarily farther east. If you have, again, the booklet and see the maps, the Medo-Persian Empire is eastward, so heading southward towards Egypt, northward, getting into Asia Minor and those areas. And that's where some of the confrontation with Greece is going to take place. But we see that, you know, he expands. And he's, the Medo-Persian Empire is larger than the Babylonian Empire in land mass, if you will, and what's been conquered. But in that expansion, as particularly as the Medo-Persian Empire enters into Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, that's when they're going to meet up with the expansion of Greece as they leave the peninsula and cross over the Ionian Sea to come to Asia Minor and greet, if you will, the Persians, and the Persians are going to lose. And so we note this anger, if you will, as we come to that he-goat, he gives us this depiction of, you know, going fast, his feet aren't even touching the ground. Again, noting the quickness at which Alexander conquered the then-known world, if you will, in conquering Persia and spreading and going all the way to the Indus River, going way past Persia, going down into Egypt, and doing that within 10 years. He lived 12 years as emperor, getting himself established, obviously, in Greece, but that 10 years to cover that territory and conquer it is still in the annals of history remarkable. You know, nothing has been ever done like that. I mean, we look at some of the spreading of Japan with its militarism back in the 20th century, going into China and getting their sphere of influence and into Southeast Asia, doesn't compare to what, you know, Alexander the Great was able to accomplish in a relatively short time. And so it again stands amazing, and that's why we have this kind of picture of this quick moving he-goat that just nothing is able to stand in its way. He takes out the Medo-Persian Empire, which would have seemed like an impossibility in that day. As Alexander the Great goes across the sea and lands in Asia Minor, he has 35,000 troops. The Medo-Persian Empire has 500,000 that are capable of fighting. He doesn't have all 500,000 there, but that's what they have at their disposal, and Alexander takes care of them as he marches through the area. And so we see this rising up, and we move on to the vision of the goat depicting that Grecian Empire. And coming from the west, again, that compass direction, that's from the Middle East, Greece is west. He's coming from that direction. And he is that one notable horn, that great horn in verse 8. He's that first one that he also mentions then later in the chapter as he describes this, that he's that notable one, but his power is cut off. He dies rather unexpectedly. Still young as far as age is concerned. And his empire, the Grecian Empire, again, as you look at your second map, the Grecian Empire is divided into four. To four of his generals. And that greatness that was Greece, if you will, as an empire, is gone. Because now you have these four generals, kings, who are going to start to vie with each other for power, for domination, to try to take over these other kingdoms to be the one top one. But while that's in play, our focus is going to be strictly on two of them as we move forward. As we note the kingdoms there in the map, we are going to be focusing really on the kings of the south and kings of the north that we see in chapter 11, referring to the Seleucid and the Ptolemies. Seleucus and Ptolemy were two of Alexander's generals. And we're going to follow them as we go forward. So we get a little glimpse, if you will, of the Seleucid kingdom with this notable little horn, as he notes in verse 9, that comes up in the midst of these four generals. And this is first referring again to the Seleucid kingdom and specifically to Antiochus the Fourth, who's also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And when we show some of the paperwork, the charting, we typically put numbers to these names because there are several Ptolemies and there are several Seleucus and Antiochus, and they typically go by the two names. Antiochus Epiphanes would be how we know him. But modern historians have started putting Roman numerals so that we can kind of delineate between them a little easier than Antiochus Epiphanes, and these others, Ptolemy, Sopater, and everything else. So we have Antiochus the Fourth, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, who is this little horn that rises up and waxes exceeding great. And he wants to expand his Seleucid Empire. The Seleucid Empire is kind of the eastern part as we divided up the Grecian Empire. Greece proper, Asia Minor, the Middle East, and Egypt. Egypt is the Ptolemies. The Middle East is the Seleucid. The other two, as far as Israel is concerned, has no bearing. Because again, our focus is ultimately on Israel. How are the Gentiles' powers affecting Israel? Well, Greece and the other one, those kingdoms don't affect Israel. But as you look at the map, if to the east of Israel is the Seleucid kingdom, east and slightly north, and to the south is the Ptolemies in Egypt, that kind of puts Israel in the crosshairs. They're going to be the marching grounds for these two to battle each other. And again, we'll see that in chapter 11. But here he notes that one of those Seleucid kings is going to cause problems in Israel. The pleasant land, as it's noted here, is a reference to Israel. The other spots down here, some of the other words, the holy people in verse 24, and giving us reference to the Israelites and what is happening here. And while I don't know that we have it in the library, probably not, kind of an extra biblical place to look, besides Josephus, which he's a historian, and he gives it in his Antiquities of the Jews. But another place to read about what we will see in chapter 11 and a little bit here is in two of the apocryphal books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They're historical, they're accurate in what they are writing about. Now, they're apocryphal, they're not scripture. The Roman Catholic Church puts it in their Bible. Yeah, some of the old Protestant Bibles had it. The original King James had the apocryphal books between the Old and the New Testament. They're interesting books to read, much like reading Josephus, if you will, or any other fiction, to me, fictional characters. But the Maccabees are a history as to what happens in Israel concerning the Seleucid kings and the Ptolemy kings. Because the Maccabees are the ones that are going to rise up and try to push off the shackles of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And we'll touch on that here in a minute with the desecrating of the temple. That is by Antiochus Epiphanes. And the problems, the intrigue that goes on there, the writer of the Maccabees is writing about that and what takes place. And the Jews that decided to side with these Gentile kings instead of being Jews and desecrate the temple and go along with it. And it helps to understand, in one sense, just what's going on the Jewish side of things. And so it is helpful. Again, it's not scripture. It's just somebody wrote this history back then, and it happens to be an accurate history. So it's profitable for us in that regard as we look at that intertestamental period between the Old Testament and the New Testament. A lot takes place, and we're touching on it here with these prophecies. But we have Antiochus Epiphanes, and he's going to come as he's battling the Ptolemies, going back and forth. He's crossing Israel. And on one of his ways back from working against Egypt, he stops in and he loots Jerusalem. He takes the gold that the temple has and removes the altars and everything else, and he sets in an altar to Zeus or Jupiter. I haven't been able to find out for sure which one. I have some call it Zeus, some call it Jupiter. Antiochus himself had been a prisoner in Rome for a while. So he was taught Roman stuff because Rome is rising. It's not a huge empire in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, which is about 175 B.C., 164 B.C. So we're moving ahead a couple hundred years here from Daniel's time as we look at this. But Rome is growing over there. And Rome is starting to flex its muscles and will overtake, you know, Greece eventually. But in that, Rome takes Antiochus Epiphanes. He's trained there. His brother gives his son as prisoner so that he can get Antiochus back. And so his son's now being trained in Rome, and he gets Antiochus back, and he becomes the king. So he may have called it Jupiter because he's had the Roman influence. To me, it doesn't really matter because Zeus is the Greek version. Jupiter is the Roman version of the same god. So whether it was actually to Jupiter or actually to Zeus, I haven't been able to determine from the stuff that I have to see. Was it literally to Zeus, therefore he was following his Greek background? Or was it named really Jupiter because of his Roman influence? But either way, it's the same god. It's just as you look at Greek mythology and Roman gods, Rome has their name for the Greek gods. Just plain and simple. They don't have different sets. They just name them by their Latin names, if you will. So we have this set up. And on that altar, they sacrifice a pig. Now, what does that do to the Jewish traditions? I mean, it's bad enough that he put an altar to Jupiter in there, but he then adds insult to injury by sacrificing a pig. He tells Jews in Jerusalem, you're no longer worshiping your God. You're worshiping our gods. And sadly, many of the Jews do. And we see some of that conspiracy here as he notes this, as he writes through here in this, prophetic vision in verse, let's read verses 10, 11, and 12 and following. He says, And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. It's alluding to the fact that some of the Jews went ahead and agreed with Antiochus and said, you know what? Oh, that's okay. Fine. To the victors go the spoil. Yeah, okay. We'll live like you. Then verse 13, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto the certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And so it is asked, how long does this desolation last? This desolation is going to provoke the Maccabees. As we noted again, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, those books talk about what happens. While many Jews kowtow to Antiochus, there are those zealous Jews that seek to stand for God. And they're going to stand up. Judas Maccabees and others, his children and the like, are going to rise up. As we look at this, it notes here this unto 2,300 days. The structure of the Hebrew, it can be like it says here, 2,300 days, or it could be referring to 1,150 days, half the number. Again, because of how the Hebrew is written, it's hard to make this out. Our translators have caught it as being 2,300 days. In either case, the chronology works because he doesn't give us an exact time of when it started, but he does show when it ends, that is, at the end of these days. And so we note this as I bring this up. In either case, the chronology of the dates works, since the ending of the time period is the cleansing of the temple, which took place on 25 Chislev in 164 BC. That's when the Maccabees pushed the Ptolemies and the Seleucids out of Jerusalem. They cleansed the temple. They were governing Israel, so to speak, for a while, until Rome comes. But they're able to have some self-government, cleanse the temple, get it rededicated, have the Feast of Dedication that we'll look at that time. But that date takes place. We know that date. So counting backwards, if we come back 2,300 days, it takes us back to about 171 BC, which just happens to be when a legitimate high priest is murdered and a pseudo line of priests assume power, which is really kind of rather interesting because of that taking place, again, in this intrigue that we have going between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the pressure that's being put on Israel. The legitimate high priest is murdered and someone else assumes that place who's not a high priest. He's not in the Aaronic line. And so, in a sense, is the temple operating biblically? No, because the high priest is supposed to be of the line of Aaron. And so some would feel that that's when at least the start of the desecration started, because we now have a high priest that is not supposed to be high priest in the office of high priest doing the high priest duties when he's not allowed to. He's not supposed to. So there's that number. If we cut it down to the 1150, that takes us back to 167 BC, which is when the temple is desecrated by Antiochus Epiphanes. And so, interesting how God takes care of this issue by showing us these two events that take place within the Israelite history that does have bearing on the fact that the temple is desecrated. The ultimate desecration, yes, is the putting, the removing of the proper temple things, the gold is taken out. Antiochus puts in an altar to Zeus or to Jupiter. He offers a pig on it. That's definitely desecrated the temple. But there was that semi-desecration, if you will, by having a wrong high priest ministering in there. So either time frame fits, because again, the ending point is the temple is cleansed after those 3, 4 years, 6, 7, depending again on how you count the dates that are the days that are noted in verse 14. So we have that time frame being taken care of. And so he tells us, you know, a little bit further in verses 23 through 24, as again he notes Antiochus Epiphanes, and many commentators believe, and so do I, that the language here is used to speak of a double fulfillment, initially by Antiochus Epiphanes. He desecrates the temple, but it also tends to picture the Antichrist when he comes in the middle of the tribulation period and desecrates the temple, because he comes in and says, "I'm God, worship me." And so Antiochus Epiphanes has always been a picture, a type of the Antichrist that is coming in the tribulation, because he did the same thing. He desecrated the temple in his day. And so will the Antichrist do the same thing, because the wording here speaks a little more towards that. But yet he is being specific, because he is referring to this notable horn that came up, this little horn in verse 9, is referring to those in verses 23 through 24. So there's kind of a double fulfillment, if you will, of noting that. And so we have these things going on that are going to prepare us again for chapter 11. And what's this effect on Daniel? Verses 26 and 27. "And the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days." In other words, it's for others to really bear in mind. This is prophetic, yes. But Daniel, it's taken care of. You don't need to dwell on it, if you will. This is a future event. "And the vision," excuse me, verse 27, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood." Again, in his day, they wouldn't. What do you mean Greece is going to be huge and do all that? No. Greece? They're just a bunch of city-states up there. No. So they wouldn't understand. It's shut up to the time when they would. And we see that coming through. And again, that's why we can't understand it. So a little more. We'll look at Daniel chapter 9, Lord willing, next week, at least part of it. And we may not get through all of it as we look at Daniel's prayer and the another prophecy that he has in chapter 9.